Margaret dressed me, yeah. Good evening, everyone. It's good to see all of you here. The people who really care about this planet are here this evening. I'm Jerry Schubel. I think I know all of you. I want to acknowledge our sponsors, Gazette Newspapers, and we have a new sponsor, the Slavic Family Foundation, and they are supporting, I think we have four lecturers who are going to be coming over the next 2 or 3 months to talk to us about various aspects of climate change and what we can do about it. Our speaker this evening is Eli Kintish. He's a reporter for Science Magazine. He's written for Slate, Discover, the MIT Technology Review, and the New Republic. He's worked as a Washington correspondent for The Forward and as a science reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. In 2005, he won the Space Journalism Prize for a series of articles on private spacecraft. And for the past 6 years, he's held a very important position at Science Magazine, which is the premier science magazine in this country. And that position is as the lead on the policy that deals with climate change and all aspects of it. His writing subjects range from coal, parachutes, obesity, genetically modified crops, to Lewis and Clark, a pair of Muslim and Jewish physicists who were friends and won separate Nobel Prizes, and he's also written about asexuals. On the geoengineering front, he has written about some of Bill Gates' funding of planet hacking research. He's written about DARPA exploring the idea of geoengineering. And earlier this year, we got to know Eli at a week-long conference that was held up in Asilomar, and I think he's going to tell you a little bit about that amazing gathering of scientists, engineers, philosophers, historians, economists, ethicists, and one very lonely poet. And I hope Eli is going to tell us about that. And his book, Hack the Planet, if you're only going to read one book about geoengineering and what it is all about, this is the one that I would recommend to you. It really is quite a remarkable book. It's engaging, it's accessible. You don't have to be a specialist to understand it. And Eli will be happy to autograph a copy for you later this evening. Eli grew up in New York. He graduated from Yale with a degree in biology, and it was only late in his undergraduate career that he realized that he wanted to be a science journalist. He plays ultimate frisbee. I have no idea what ultimate frisbee is, Eli. And he builds furniture, he cooks, and he listens to music for fun, and he's quite an amazing young man. Please welcome Eli Kintish.
Thank you, Jerry, for such a really kind introduction. I'm Eli Kintish from Science Magazine. It means a lot to me that you all came out, and I hope that you'll find my talk interesting and we'll have a vigorous discussion, because this is a really controversial and I think engaging idea. And I think I want to start this talk by putting you a little bit in my shoes, because 3 years ago, I didn't know what geoengineering was. And only 3 years later, I've written a book about it. I got a phone call from a Harvard scientist named Dan Schrag. He's kind of known as a troublemaker. He's a little bit of a provocateur. And he wanted to have a meeting on the subject, geoengineering. And I didn't know what it was. Basically, the idea of the meeting was to bring scientists on this radical, you know, sort of fringe idea, geoengineering, which is about to explain to you, and bring them to the really premier top scientists at Harvard, MIT, and some other institutions. And this is really where we are with geoengineering. It was this idea that we had the folks on the edges and the establishment. And everyone thought that, as in the past, this idea of controlling the world's climate, which is the idea of geoengineering, would be rejected by the leading lights in the field. And one of the scientists, David Battisti, is in the first chapter of my book, and I thought he was particularly important because he had always talked about the importance of cutting greenhouse gases, as all the scientists at that meeting had. But he had particular personal feelings that the idea of controlling the Earth's climate on a mass scale is almost implausible to think about, and possibly dangerous to consider and to talk about. But actually, at that meeting, they did a show of hands to ask the scientists, who thinks we ought to study this? And by the end of that meeting, David Battisti, who had come to Harvard just 2 days before, he's from the University of Washington, Battisti had raised his hand and said, we ought to look into this. So what was it that happened at that meeting that really changed these scientists who thought that they were going to reject this idea and made them willing to actually study it, study this radical concept? And I think it's the Anthropocene. And what the Anthropocene is, it's a new era on this Earth. We've had previous geologic eras in the past, the Eocene, the Pliocene. The Anthropocene was a term invented by another provocateur, another troublemaker scientist named Paul Crutzen. He's also a Nobel Prize winner, and he's very, very smart. He's Dutch, although he works in Germany. And he named the Anthropocene for the era, geologic era we're in now, because everywhere he looked on the planet, he saw the unmistakable hand of mankind. So you look in the sky, you see a mark carbon dioxide. You look in the ocean, you see a growing acidification, levels of certain nutrients in the ocean and in lakes because of humans. And I think this meeting really marked for us this era of geoengineering as a kind of almost uber Anthropocene. Because this meeting wasn't just saying, because of inadvertent actions over the last 200 years, humanity is having this effect on the Earth, but because of those effects and the potential risks of those effects, some leading scientists at that meeting would consider actually purposefully altering the planet's temperature. And since 2007, just so you don't leave the room right now thinking this is an absolutely outrageous idea, the Royal Society of the United Kingdom, the National Academy of Sciences, the American Geophysical Union, these major bodies of science have each embraced the idea that we ought to study this radical and really disturbing concept of geoengineering. And what my book is about is basically why that happened. How did such a radical idea become essentially mainstream opinion that we should look into this? And I think, just to remind us how controversial we're talking, I mean, one of the ideas at that meeting was to build these boats, and these boats would wander the Earth's seas. They're about 40 tons each. They're enormous. They're like 30 feet high. They're wind-powered. These are special sails. And they would spray seawater into clouds and potentially brighten those clouds. I wanted to start the talk by giving you a sense of the radical nature of some of these concepts. And I'll tell you a little more about this concept later, but just to give you a sense, this is where we're at. This is the era of geoengineering, when crazy ideas like brightening sea clouds and the ocean are being considered and evaluated and really encouraged by leading lights in climate science. And so why did we get to this point? What was it that those scientists at Harvard were hearing that really made them so frightened that they would consider supporting research into geoengineering? The first thing I would say is that carbon emissions are skyrocketing. These colored bars here indicate forecasts that scientists put together for the 2007 major report, an international report called the IPCC. That report, it turns out, was wildly, wildly optimistic. We hoped that emissions were going to stay under this level of roughly, 9 billion tons of carbon a year. This takes into account things like methane and other greenhouse gases in addition to carbon dioxide. But we were optimistic. We thought that the most extreme was this red line, but it turns out we're emitting even more than what we thought just 4 years ago. And everyone in this room probably has ideas as to why. the economic growth of China, continued, you know, larger cars and, you know, more rainforests getting cut down. And the truth of what those climate scientists at Harvard heard is that we could stop emissions. I mean, it is, we spend much more on healthcare all around the world than we would need to spend on completely radically changing our energy system. Just to give you a sense, 40% of greenhouse gas emissions come from electricity production, and we certainly have in our ability to transform that sector with wind power and solar power and, you know, carbon, you know, fossil fuel burning, in which we would capture the carbon dioxide. We don't know exactly how much it would cost, but even the most pessimistic estimates say a couple percent GDP. Well, that's what we spend on the military. So that has to raise a question: if we really needed to, could we stop emissions? Another thing that the scientists at Harvard heard at that meeting that I went to is the system has a certain momentum. Now, this is this shows you that when you the black lines are five-year averages temperature, and you see this is the NASA data set. You see the global warming we've seen in this planet since the since the 1960s or so, and you see here a slight slowing that scientists are understanding now. But there's a lot of momentum in this system, and here's an example of some of that momentum. You've got ocean temperatures, you know, in the last few years, somewhat flat, also rising, but overall, we see that momentum of warming temperatures. We see it in the disappearance of mountain glaciers all around the world. We see hundreds and hundreds of species changing their ranges to move closer to the poles as the temperatures rise in the tropics. We see the loss of various species, which we think is connected to climate change. We see, obviously, disappearance of sea ice in the Arctic getting faster and faster, as well as when you look at the trends, as well as the loss of the ice sheets. So everywhere around the world, we're seeing this momentum. And the truth of the matter with climate change and with global warming is that even if you stopped carbon emissions tomorrow, just like when you take a pot off the stove that you've been heating up, the water will continue to warm. So scientists have forecast that even if you stopped putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, you would continue to see warming. And so what we have with the system is momentum. And that momentum is sort of like trying to steer a giant ocean liner, like the one you guys have here in Long Beach. But we also have a scary aspect of that momentum. We have uncertainty. Now, this is the most wonky graph I promise I'll show you. This number, climate sensitivity, basically means if we were to double the amount of carbon we put in the atmosphere, how much would the planet warm? The optimistic aspects of it are here. The planet might warm only 1 or 2 degrees Celsius. Now, that might cause a lot of problems, but here are the worst-case scenarios. We think unlikely. That's why the curve is shaped this way. We think it's unlikely that the planet would go up by, you know, what's 8 degrees Celsius. That's nearly 18 degrees Fahrenheit. We think it's unlikely, but we don't know. So you've got two things. You've got momentum, and you've got uncertainty. You've got a giant ocean liner you're trying to steer, but you don't know how much you need to steer it or how bad the obstacles are. And, you know, is this momentum we're facing deadly already? There was one scientist at the meeting at Cambridge, at Harvard, who felt as though we've actually gotten to the point where we need to start cooling the planet directly now. Not stopping cutting emissions, but he said, just sort of like as a palliative, to lower our risk of the worst case scenarios, we'd have to start doing that. I want to sort of step back and talk about what I think geoengineering really is. I think geoengineering is an emergency procedure. It is equivalent to a fire insurance policy or a parachute, or as I described it here, sort of emergency procedures for an airplane, that seatback card that you have in an airplane. You hope to never have to do anything on that card, but you'd be foolish to fly without one, and you'd be foolish to build a house without insurance. And we used to think that just cutting emissions was our insurance, but what happened at Harvard is we realized that there's enough risk in the system, the worst-case scenarios are plausible enough that it might make sense to at least look into some of these radical schemes. And as I just point out, I actually made one of these cards. You know, we don't have many options when it comes to the worst-case scenarios of global warming. In my book, I go into what we know from the past in terms of extreme climate change. We know that in the past, sea level has gone up by tens of meters with the kind of carbon emissions that we're putting out now. We know that there have been massive drought conditions, even more extreme than the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. We know that the planet is capable of, in natural ways, of having these extreme events. And so the question is, now that we're pushing the planet, kind of like, you know, messing with an angry animal with a stick, the question is, how much can it take? And as I point out, obviously, there's no emergency exits on this particular vehicle. And so I think geoengineering, the ultimate answer, is geoengineering is a bad idea. But it's a bad idea whose time has come. And so that's what my book is about. What I found as I started to look into this radical idea of actually cooling the planet, and I'll explain to you soon how we would do it if we were ever to try this almost unthinkable step, is that actually scientists have looked into this idea in the past. First of all, it's a kind of recurring theme in literature and in myth that, you know, humans or maybe gods would alter the weather. You think of Greek myth, you think of Odysseus, and you think of sci-fi, and you know, more recently like Dune and Star Trek. The idea of controlling the climate is kind of this embedded human trope. But I found that as I studied sort of the history of climate science, I found interest in geoengineering going way back to the very beginning. So 1908, a really important climate scientist named Svante Arrhenius, he's a Swedish, he was one of the first scientists to really nail the idea that carbon dioxide was connected to the planet's temperature, atmospheric carbon dioxide. He did this in a wild effort where he sat for months on end with temperature readings and with a giant globe, if you can imagine a global map, with little squares measuring temperature changes and carbon dioxide, and was the first person to really suggest that there was a link. He actually won the Nobel Prize for something else. He was that smart. But in 1908, he said that humanity ought to pursue a virtuous course and burn fossil fuels to stave off an ice age. So he saw, and he lived in Sweden where it was freezing, obviously, he saw burning fossil fuels as a kind of advertent geoengineering to warm the planet to his liking. In the middle of the century, the Soviets, they started to think of geoengineering as a way to improve their climate, even more radically than the Swedish guy. So, for example, I came upon this pamphlet in the Library of Congress, a really remarkable document. It was translated into English so I could read it, and it was by these Soviet thinkers. It reads really like science fiction. They imagine putting rings around the Earth to reflect light in certain places on the planet. They imagine completely melting all of Siberia and opening up the Arctic to ships and planting crops all over the northern side of the Soviet Union. They imagine altering weather. They really thought that they could in the same way that they had, you know, completely changed Russian society, they thought they could radically alter the land that they controlled. And, you know, one of their leading scientists was a guy named Bodiko. And in the 50s, you know, going along with this idea, Bodiko actually patented a method of melting snow by distributing little bits of rubber, little black rubber, along the snow. And that would make the rubber more absorb the sun's rays and that would melt the snow. And then I learned in the 60s, Bodico started to realize how sensitive the planet might be. And he started to see the evidence of global warming. And so Bodico actually, in some of his later writings, said, wait a second, we might need to cool the planet if we had to. So he was, before advocating an idea of melting the snow, now he's thinking about cooling the planet, and that was by actually altering the reflectivity of the atmosphere. And I'm going to talk a little more about that. And the Americans, at the same time in the 50s and 60s, they were thinking about altering the planet's atmosphere. They were more focused a little more on weather. And there was a real fear that there was going to be a war over climate fighting, and a weather modification war. You might be able to influence rainstorms on your enemies, and you also might be able to cause a drought if you could understand it. And that was the sort of feeling of the era. Fast forward to 1995, and the Kyoto Protocol is being proposed, actually 1997, I'm sorry. Kyoto Protocol has been signed in Japan, it's being brought to Washington, and Edward Teller, the father of the atomic bomb, the father of the hydrogen bomb, he writes an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal and says, Kyoto Protocol is not a good way to solve this global warming problem if we have a problem. He says, we should do geoengineering. We should do what Bodico said in the 60s and alter the stratosphere to block the sun's rays. And then 5 years later, in one of his last scientific papers, Edward Teller writes, we should do geoengineering in case there's an ice age. So he was advocating studying this idea in case the planet started to cool off. I guess it's the case of, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But the other kind of history I think was important to include in my book, along with the idea that scientists were thinking about altering the planet's climate, was there are lots of other examples of large-scale environmental transformations that humans have tried to do. One example you might know about is, from the Soviet era, the Soviets were trying to bring water to areas outside the Aral Sea, which is like the fourth largest lake in the world. And to do so, they altered rivers with hundreds of miles of canals, and they ended up basically destroying the Aral Sea, what had been this teeming ecosystem with fascinating fish species, was pretty much destroyed, and it became a giant salt patch, and all that salt got whipped up by the winds and now causes all sorts of problems with people's lungs in that whole area, and the United Nations is now trying to fix the problem. Other examples I include in my book are efforts in the 1970s to build artificial reefs off Florida. They used tires, and they thought, oh, this is a win-win solution. You could just tie the tires together, make artificial reefs. We can keep the tires out of our landfills and grow lots of fish in places where we don't have natural reefs. Well, the tires got loose, and they would roll with the underwater tides and destroy everything in their path. And to this day, they're still washing up along the beaches of Florida, and they hire convicts in their orange jumpsuits to pick up the tires. Finally, there are successful examples of introducing insect and, I don't know about amphibian, but at least insect species are introduced and successfully. But in my book, I highlight some of the biggest failures of this technique of messing with ecosystems to try to fix a problem. One of them was in the West in the 1970s. You had this problem, the spotted knapweed. The idea was that maybe we would destroy this species, which is raising hell on all this rangeland. Maybe we could introduce this gall fly. And the gall fly, it turns out, eats the spotted knapweed's seeds. But it turns out that mice came along and ate the flies. And now there's a risk, now there's fears that Ebola might be growing in the mice. So you have all these examples of previous efforts to try to mess with ecosystems on a large scale with all the best intentions, but that doesn't always work. And this is just one last thing I wanted to show you, which is, this is 1965. This is the first time that an official body of the U.S. government told the president, essentially in a public document, of the risks of atmospheric CO2. And in this document, the first time, they talk about the idea, they don't talk about cutting emissions and building more efficient cars or using alternative forms of energy. They talk about deliberately bringing about controversial climate changes. So, I mean, this is really the spirit of the 60s. But I thought it was interesting that as early as that, you've had scientists thinking about the most extreme kinds of climate changes. So, as I said, in terms of where we've been, geoengineering has been part of the talk, and now geoengineering is really in the forefront. And the most prominent scientists in the world in climate are now, I would say, grudgingly agreeing that we need to think about geoengineering. But it's not something that scientists are doing happily. There was a big fight in 2006 over a proposed paper by this radical guy I mentioned before, this Dutch scientist, Crutzen. Crutzen wanted to put out a paper saying, we need to study geoengineering. And what ensued was a six-month email war between scientists over whether this paper should even be published. All he said was, we ought to study the idea. But what scientists feared is that even by saying that, he would encourage people to leave aside the really important effort of cutting our greenhouse gas emissions. Essentially, the fear was that by Crutzen, a Nobel Prize winner, saying we need to study this radical alternative, it would weaken any potential momentum that there was building to actually reverse our really damaging trajectory when it comes to carbon emissions. And what happened in the end is they agreed to publish the paper. It appeared in a journal called Climatic Change, which is one of the premier journals in climate science. But it came along with five other essays that talked about the risks of talking about geoengineering and the risks of geoengineering, and it's a bad idea, it's a good idea. This made the Science Times and the New York Times, and this really was the thing that led to the Harvard meeting, and I would say that the Harvard meeting led to the rest of the changes I've described in terms of main organizations, mainline organizations embracing geoengineering. So now I'm going to talk about what actually these ideas are. There's two ways. First, let's step back and make sure everyone understands the essential nature of the problem of climate change and global warming. The essential problem is that usually what happens is that as the sun's rays strike the Earth, a certain fraction get reflected up into space, and a certain fraction continue out into the atmosphere. But because of the things we're putting into the atmosphere, these so-called greenhouse gases, we reflect a greater percentage of that heat, that radiation, back to the Earth. That's the greenhouse. We're trapping a tiny percent more each year than we did before. And that's why the planet's temperature is rising. And so one strategy to geoengineer the planet to try to reverse global warming might be to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And this is one technique I illustrated on that safety card you saw. And that technique is known as iron fertilization. Very quickly, the idea is to grow massive blooms of algae, sort of like growing grass or trees. Algae is a plant, and algae pulls carbon dioxide out of the air as it grows. And so in this flavor of geoengineering, the carbon-sucking flavor, the algae is a potential tool. And, you would essentially use iron, this trace nutrient, put it into the ocean in the right place, and as you grow algae, you would send carbon dioxide to the deep ocean, maybe when the algae gets eaten, maybe the algae dies. There are different theories. This has been tried in a number of small experiments. But last year, for the first time, scientists from India and Germany conducted the first ever large experiment of iron fertilization. And in my book, I describe the giant political fight that caused within the German government and some of the challenges they had along that journey. One of the challenges is we don't know what the side effects of this technique may be. We don't know whether growing algae blooms to suck in carbon dioxide might, for example, alter ecosystems in ways we don't understand. And maybe it might grow algae in a way that would deplete oxygen from the ocean, harming other species. There are certain measured fluxes of greenhouse gases like methane that come from the ecosystems that algae helps grow. And so you actually might be taking carbon dioxide out of the air through your algae bloom in your carbon-sucking mission, but you might be creating methane emissions, and methane is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Finally, you know, if you were to be doing this for companies, and in my book I describe how companies have tried to pursue geoengineering along these lines, you might cause a kind of rush of companies into the ocean to do this. And so we might see the kind of exploitation of the ocean that we've seen for other kinds of natural resources. The only other thing I'll say about carbon removal techniques is you might do it with natural ecosystems like growing larger algae blooms. You might do it by speeding up the growth of forests. You might do it by building machines. There are scientists at the University of Calgary and Columbia University who are building giant carbon-sucking machines that would essentially filter the planet's air and remove carbon dioxide from it the way that we do in submarines or in spaceships. And so there are different techniques to remove carbon from the sky. There's also techniques that would alter ocean chemistry. By adding certain nutrients to the ocean and certain minerals, you might utilize the ocean's ability to act as a carbon sponge and maybe enhance that ability. So there are different techniques. So that's the carbon sucking. The other technique doesn't get at the problem of the carbon, but rather is even more extreme because it would change the planet's actual reflectivity. And so just in this cartoon I show, looking out the window, you see the effects of global warming, in this case, you know, loss of ice sheets and, you know, the rising sea, and you might, you know, seek to spray what essentially would be sulfur compounds up into the stratosphere. Now, we know that when volcanoes erupt, like in 1991 with Mount Pinatubo, their eruptions can cool the planet. We know that because in 1991, for example, we saw temperatures around the world go down by a degree Fahrenheit in a year. And that's because Mount Pinatubo sprayed 10 million tons of sulfur dioxide up into the stratosphere, and it stayed there like a giant cloud, and it cooled the planet. This also happened I can't remember the year now, it was about the 1850s, but it's that famous painting of The Scream by Edward Munch, I think. It shows these beautiful sunsets that it turns out when you have volcanic eruptions, you get these great sunsets. You also get darker skies, and that year is known as the year without a summer because temperatures plummeted around the world because this gunk was up in the sky blocking the sun's rays. So the idea was we would somehow mimic this natural cooling effect that volcanoes cause. It's a radical concept. But actually, I didn't invent this idea of using a tube and these are balloons and spraying stuff. A guy by the name of Nathan Myhrvold, he's an advisor of Bill Gates, he came up with the concept. And Nathan Myhrvold has actually patented this technique, which would cool the planet by, as he puts it, little more than a coal plant and a tube and a balloon. You basically take the pollution, which is coming down right now in the troposphere, the lower part of the atmosphere, and you put it in the stratosphere above the weather. And there it would stay for many months, as we saw with Mount Pinatubo. So obviously, this is a very radical idea, the idea of actually purposefully changing the planet's temperature. And I just named three of the possible side effects here. I mean, we know in 1991 that as particles got into the stratosphere, where they remained for many months, they actually robbed the planet of radiation, of heat. And by doing that, we saw stream gauges around the world show a 10% drop in the amount of water that was running through them. And the reason for that is that the planet requires solar energy to put moisture up into the sky, and then it falls down as rain. And so in your efforts to cool the planet, you might be taking moisture that we need out of the precipitation system. We also know that when there's particles up in the stratosphere, they damage the ozone layer because they provide a surface on which these catalytic reactions, they provide a catalyst, essentially, for natural reactions to move faster and destroy ozone. And finally, you know, there might be these unintended consequences of doing this. And my book is full of scientists dreaming up possible unintended consequences, and some of you in the audience, I'm hoping, might suggest some. One risk of cooling the planet with this technique, which I sort of dubbed the Pinatubo option, because it's like Mount Pinatubo in 1991, one idea is that, say, the countries of the world refuse to cut their carbon emissions, so we continue to put this warming pollution up into the atmosphere. So you're pushing on it with the carbon dioxide. Then you start pulling on it with this geoengineering, with the Pinatubo option. Well, say you have a war, or there's some disruption, and the facility where you're cooling the planet, your planet cooling thermostat area, is destroyed. Suddenly, the climate models show you would have this rapid warming. It would be like a spring being released. And so there's a real risk of thinking about geoengineering along these terms. So the last part of my talk, I want to sort of look at what are some of the other issues that this radical idea of cooling the planet, very quickly, I thought, everyone loves the other geoengineering ideas, and so I'd go through them. This idea is, I showed you earlier, involves the idea of increasing the albedo, the brightness, of sea clouds. And so if before we were trying to make the stratosphere brighter, here we're trying to make the lower clouds brighter. And that's done because we know that when ships drive through the ocean, we see with satellites, their particles actually lead to brighter clouds because those particles enter clouds and they provide more surfaces on which to form cloud particles, essentially. So you have the same amount of water in the clouds, but they're distributed into smaller particles. More particles mean more surface area, more cloud particles, essentially. And more surface area means brighter clouds. And so scientists in England have come up with techniques, as I described before, how this would work theoretically and how you might do it with a robotic boat. An even more radical idea to cool the planet would be to, instead of allowing the radiation to get to the planet, you would stop the radiation from ever getting there. And so this is kind of that crazy Soviet idea of putting a parasol or a blocker around the Earth, but this is this actually was published only a few years ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a very prestigious journal. And it was a University of Arizona optics expert who usually builds some of the world's greatest telescopes with lenses and mirrors. And his idea was that we would actually block sunlight from striking the Earth. And he knows this is a radical notion. After all, he estimated it would cost $1 to $5 trillion. It would easily be the biggest thing that had ever been designed by many factors of 1,000, and would cost, and I think he said it would take something like 50 years to build or something. You'd be firing off these tiny disks that they're about the size of manholes, but they're much thinner than a slice of paper. you would block 2% of the sun's rays in his scheme by sitting the disks at this point here, where the gravity between the sun and the earth is balanced, and so something would supposedly sit stably there. Obviously a wild idea. Even the scientist who came up with it knows that. He doesn't think this is the solution, but thinks it'd be stupid not to think about it. And obviously, as the idea of geoengineering has become more and more well-known, it's started to engender all sorts of controversy. So this is a group in Canada called the ETC Group, and they held a contest, come up with your own geoengineering idea. It was meant to mock the whole concept. And the winning entry was to pull the Earth into a new orbit with 16 space shuttles. And that's how we would cool the planet. Subsequent to that, there's actually been an international movement to prevent geoengineering. I don't exactly know what they mean. Maybe they mean geoengineering experiments. Maybe they think we should create a moratorium. They have certain ideas. But since no one's talking about doing it right now, just studying it, in my opinion, it's not clear what opposing geoengineering really means at the end of the day. I sort of, in the last few minutes of my talk, kind of turn to some of the larger issues which I think this idea of geoengineering raises. Because I think that, as I said in the beginning, this is a new era in our time on Earth. And I think I was saying to the director here, Jerry, at dinner tonight that, you know, what we've learned from the oil spill, I think, in the Gulf of Mexico, I think has implications for geoengineering. For one, I think that in this era of the Anthropocene and in this era of geoengineering, the kind of challenges we're going to be facing are kind of on a mass scale. You know, there had been oil spills before, but never a gusher on the bottom of the ocean. And so we really were ill-prepared to prevent it from happening or to prevent or really to respond to it. The kind of challenges we're going to face that might raise even the possibility of doing geoengineering are completely new nature of challenges. In the same way that scientists haven't had to add dispersant chemical to a gushing oil spill at the bottom, you know, a mile down in the ocean ever before, it's a whole new kind of challenge on a much larger scale. I also think that the question of intentionality that geoengineering raises, the idea that we would actually choose to, you know, try to deploy one of these radical schemes. I think that if we can't purposefully, you know, fix an oil spill, that's just, the other way to look at it is just a mile down in the ocean. I mean, it's right there. If we can't fix an oil spill, how could you imagine tackling the Earth's radiation balance or on a mass scale, removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere? I think that we're in this new era where we're having to ask these really uncomfortable questions. I also think that we're going to have to start thinking about geoengineering as almost a kind of proliferation risk. What I didn't tell you about some of these methods is that if you think about the Earth's climate challenge right now as a kind of question of levers, we are pushing with carbon dioxide relatively softly. It's a small percentage. I mean, it's 0.04% of the atmosphere is carbon dioxide, essentially. And yet that's having the warming effects that I've shown. So we're sort of in this era of understanding these levers. A little bit of carbon dioxide is causing a massive amount of acidification, destroying coral all around the Earth. A little bit of carbon dioxide is causing this warming. And methane has this outsize effect. And so from the other perspective, there's a kind of allure to that idea of levers. Maybe we can take advantage of those levers and reverse the problem. A little bit of, 10 billion tons of sulfur dioxide is not that much on the global scale, and yet it cooled the planet by a degree Fahrenheit in 1991. And so what we're learning is the real potency of these planetary levers. And so along those lines, how do you start to study those levers safely? The first danger is that you'll have these environmental effects simply by doing tests. And so the risk is, the question you might raise is, okay, let's have a moratorium like those activists say. Let's not do tests. There's actually a risk to not doing the tests. Because since geoengineering is such a potent idea, and we've shown that a relatively small amount of particles can have this cooling effect, if you don't study it now, 15 years from now, some other country might do it. And do you want your scientists to have studied it to understand the implications? Because if you don't, you won't know what the possible risks could be and how to mitigate those risks. So there's a way in which geoengineering has become a proliferation danger. In fact, the cost estimates for doing the Pinatubo option, putting up sulfur into the stratosphere to cool the planet, are almost outrageously low. I mean, they're realistic. These are professional engineers thinking up how much this would cost. And I mean, the most expensive estimates I've seen to kind of do a Pinatubo type eruption, essentially, is something on the order of $1 to $2 billion a year. That sounds like a lot, but on the global scheme, that's nothing, essentially. That cost wouldn't cause the planet, the nations of the world not to do it or the nations to do it. It's essentially, at that level of cost, cost is simply not a factor. Because if we were going to deploy the Pinatubo option, we're not going to be thinking about how much it's going to cost. I mean, the bigger issues are who's going to pay for it, and the bigger issues are who's going to possibly, suffer ill consequences and what the risks would be. The other questions we need to think about in terms of the risks of geoengineering is, would simply talking about this option cause people to stop cutting greenhouse gas emissions? Now, you might say, well, we're not doing it at all. Eli, you just showed us this graph. Our emissions are skyrocketing, and it's not clear what cuts are going to happen in the future. I mean, if you've been looking at the newspaper, you see that the U.S. Senate is now considering greenhouse gas emissions cuts for the United States, but they're pretty weak, and I'd say it's a better than 50-50 chance that they're not going to happen this year, or if they do, they'll be very watered down. The UN process, which culminated in Copenhagen, is pretty much a big disaster up till now. It's unclear whether China's going to do anything before the United States does and whether the United States is going to go, and so we're at a point where the effort to cut emissions is having some momentum, but it's pretty weak. And now we're going to start talking about geoengineering. In my book, I start to describe how some opponents of cutting greenhouse gas emissions have started to embrace geoengineering. And I raise some potential reasons that is. I mean, it could be that the reason that the American Enterprise Institute has a geoengineering sort of program is that the American Enterprise Institute thinks of climate change as a problem with temperature rather than a problem with carbon dioxide. I in my book, I go into those possibilities. But the point is that geoengineering is a risk even if you don't do it. Just talking about it might encourage people to point to this technical solution and say, the scientists can fix the problem. We don't need to change our lifestyles or change the way we make energy. There's also larger questions about whether we would kill each other just discussing this. If we can't get along as nations and effectively cut our greenhouse gas emissions, which we've been unable to do, as I showed, can we really realistically imagine that we'd be able to get along in a process of actually turning the Earth's thermostat? It's a kind of outrageous idea, and I think that the international agreements or institutions, what have you, that exist now are really ill-equipped to even discuss this problem effectively. We just don't have a way that we can get along to think about something as radical as geoengineering. An effort was started along these lines about 3 or 4 months ago. 100 scientists from around the world met in Asilomar, California. This is a retreat center south of San Francisco. And that retreat center was the site in 1978, it was It was the site of a very important meeting for molecular biology. And this was at the point where scientists in molecular biology were starting to realize that doing experiments in the lab might lead to dangerous microbes getting out and causing diseases. This was sort of the infancy of, you know, molecular biology and the biotech revolution that has really changed the world. And so at the same place that their predecessors in the molecular biology sciences had held this meeting, climate scientists had this meeting on geoengineering, and that's where I met Jerry. And that meeting's goal was to come up with ways that we might study this radical idea without essentially killing each other, because it really raises new risks. One of the big questions that scientists and ethicists and lawyers raised at that meeting was, how do you compensate, how do you come up with a fair way to do this and compensate someone who was, you know, harmed? If by doing a geoengineering experiment, you actually cause an effect just by studying it, trying it on a local scale, maybe you're trying to cool the Arctic with some local cooling, would you be able to identify if some storms or a drought or the loss of rainfall, as I described, would you be able to actually connect the geoengineering test with that effect? And a lot of the scientists at this meeting really felt we'd be unable to. So that raises two disturbing questions. First, my idea of describing this as an emergency response, your seat back pocket emergency card, maybe that's faulty. Maybe we won't know that. Maybe our knowledge of the climate system is limited to the extent that we won't know whether we're facing a climate emergency until it's already happening. And the second problem is, would we be able to connect some sort of global scale geoengineering effort with a particular effect, with a particular symptom or, you know, response, if you will? This is a big challenge in medical tests. If you're trying to understand a drug, essentially you start with a small experiment with a mice or with microbes. You try the drug. You get some amount of useful information. But as you scale from that model up to humans, you trade risk for information. You take on more and more risk, and you get more and more information. And so sometimes some scientists feel that in order to get sufficient information to make, you know, informed decisions about geoengineering, we might essentially have to do a global experiment. You know, the only time we'd actually understand geoengineering is to do it on a global scale, because otherwise you won't be able to tell what effects are the result of your experiment over there in the Arctic and what effects are just natural noise. So that's the end of my talk. I think that geoengineering raises all these new issues. I encourage you to buy the book, of course, but also I'm keeping a blog at this address, and I'm really eager to get your questions about a topic that's really fascinated me. And thank you very much for listening.
It's almost kind of a yin and a yang question. We've geoengineered ourselves into this predicament, so not to study the alternatives, which we'll learn from as we go along, you know, you can prove the thesis, in other words. I mean, where's the resistance to that?
I'm not so sure we geoengineered ourselves into this problem. We made a mess. And I think that's important to...
Well, we did do it on purpose.
Yes. We've shown that human activity can have global effects. And that's important. I think that that's actually a message which hasn't gotten across. I don't think most people necessarily in the world know that we have this potential, you know, power as a species. But I think the reason that I correct you in... suggest the reason that I make a distinction between geoengineering to reverse global warming and the original problem is that I think there are a lot of risks to geoengineering, but I think that they need to be explored. And I hope that the planet is less sensitive than the worst-case scenario suggests, and we'll never need to do this. I mean, it's kind of like building nuclear weapons. You hope you'll never have to do it, but you know, before Obama came along, the assumption was we need them. Now, we'll see. I think it's unrealistic to think that any time in in most of our lifetimes we're going to see an abolishment of nuclear weapons, but you can understand essentially that there's a kind of need to understand the response to the risk and the mess we've made.
So just to add to the discussion, I think we didn't know what we were doing before with creating CO2, but we do now. So creating CO2 now is purposeful. We know what the result is. So we are geoengineering, at least from this moment forward.
Yes, I absolutely agree. When was the moment that, you know, the Anthropocene started for real? Was it when Jim Henson was testifying in front of the Senate in 1988 saying that global warming is real? Was that the moment where we were given the information as a global society and we had that chance to start to change the slope of the curve? Is it now? Is it the 1965 report that I showed where President Lyndon Johnson was told, you know, carbon dioxide is warming the planet? So, it's a really good point.
What do you think the common public's input should be in this process?
I think that's a really important question. I don't think we've had an international debate like this ever before. The idea of whether we should be trying to mess with the planet's temperature is a whole new idea. There are plenty of people in the world that don't even know that global warming is happening. I'm not talking about people who get media who think it's a hoax. I'm saying there are people who don't even, you know, there are many billions of, you know, there are probably billions of people who simply don't know that global warming exists. And so how do you include them in a discussion about how to respond to it with these potentially radical means? I don't think we've really come to terms with it. And one of the debates at this sort of key Asilomar conference was, well, we have the UN work. And one of the controversial ideas that was batted around at that meeting was, well, if the UN can't get its act together to cut greenhouse gas emissions, and we saw in Copenhagen that this UN-centered process isn't working where you try to get everyone on board, you know, how could you ever imagine everyone on board for a decision as to whether to deploy the Pinatubo option? So a diplomat at that meeting named Richard Benedict, he got up and said, we should just have 15 countries, and here are the 15 countries, and they'll decide. You can just imagine surprisingly, the U.S. was one of them. It opens whole new fascinating questions about diplomacy. And I'd say the most important thing right now is to cut emissions. And when you think about geoengineering, to think about it as, you know, something we need to study but not do right now. We just don't know enough about it.
Hi, Eli. I commend you on your effort to try to educate the general population here on the problems that we face maybe in the next few generations. But when I went to school, I was taught that scientists answer questions, but engineers solve problems.
Right.
And I think it's a lot easier to answer questions than it is to solve problems. For example, we can't even figure out how to keep 12 people alive for 1 year in Earth's orbiting satellite. How are we going to solve the problems that to keep 13 billion people for the next 10,000 years? It's an enormous problem, and I commend you on raising the issue in your book. I'd like your comments on that.
Thanks a lot. I do think that I do think that we're getting we can't have engineering without scientists. That's why we're in the we can't have engineering without science. That's why we're in this big pickle with the greenhouse gas emissions, because we had these amazing petroleum engineers and coal engineers, and we built all this great stuff. We didn't have the science behind us. But we can't have science without engineers, because we couldn't do half these ideas if we didn't have smart people to come up with ways to do it. Now, I think that there is a kind of, I think in this country, especially in the 60s, we almost had this American religion around engineering. I think, and a lot of my book has to do with this question of, well, science got us into this mess and engineering got us into this mess. Will science and engineering get us out of it? Or can we trust it? I asked the question, will science be our downfall or will science be our savior? And I think as a society, you know, we have to continually ask that question. And it is going to take an acknowledgement that you can't have one without the other. And I think we're a lot better, you know, like you said, about finding things out than fixing problems. I'll add, I think we're also better at making problems than we are at fixing them. I'm sure each of you may have an opinion on that.
My favorite example of how engineers can solve problems, back in the days of the guillotine, the rule was that if your head didn't fall, get cut off, you walked away. And there were three people lined up for the guillotine, and one was a businessman, and the blade shop stopped just short of his neck, and he walked away. He was convinced because he was so important to the community. The next one was a minister, and it stopped short, a fraction of an inch from his neck. He walked away, and he believed it was God. The third one was an engineer. He said, I can solve this problem. He tinkered. He made a slight adjustment to the guillotine, and the last thing that was seen was his head rolling down the road. So, all right.
You have several times referred to the unforeseen consequences of each of the experiments you described. I'm about to suggest we're in a position where we don't know.
Absolutely.
We just don't know. And as we design remedies, we should also design ways to monitor the effect of the remedy, because we're dealing with unknown ecosystems worldwide, and we really don't know. We must design some ways so that we're aware of what's happening.
Well, I'll say a couple things on that. First, I quote the eminent linguist and poet Donald Rumsfeld, who famously said we need to watch out for unks, unknown unknowns. And he was derided for that, but he was absolutely right. Now, in his case, he didn't understand the unks. They turned out to be more unk, I guess, than he expected. But you're absolutely right. A central part of our, while it might be easy to put this tube next to a coal plant and on a balloon and put it up into the sky, you must spend hundreds, maybe billions of dollars on new types of satellites to understand the implication. And the truth is, we don't understand the system well enough right now. That's one of the reasons that scientists have been so wary of geoengineering in the past. I'll mention two examples. We don't even know where all the carbon on Earth goes. We don't have an accounting of what they call the carbon budget. We know that the main sink is the ocean, but we don't know the exact size. And so one of the schemes I raised was messing with that sink, growing these giant algae blooms to enhance it. Second example I'll give you is the role of clouds. One of the biggest difficulties for climate science in their models is to give the proper reflectivity or heat absorption to clouds. Do clouds offer a net cooling or a net warming? And how will a warming atmosphere in the future lead to more or fewer clouds? It's a very complex question. And yet, one geoengineering scheme I mentioned of messing with the low clouds, changes of clouds, and there's another scheme of actually enhancing the high clouds, they're stratocumulus, the ones that are, you know, high up that you see in your airplanes. And so we're talking about altering some of the most mysterious aspects of our climate system. So you're absolutely right. And, you know, most of the scientists, I'll say to their credit, do have a sense of the hubris involved. And I wouldn't have written this book if it was just cranks. Because the thing that scared me the most when I went to Harvard, which was that the scientists going for research in this weren't weirdos and megalomaniacs and Edward Teller, you know, science as God types. These were very measured, careful, well-published, respected scientists. That was the scariest thing of all. I was hoping that it would be rejected by these guys, but as I say in the first chapter of my book, in this really sort of humble moment, I think for our species, the leading scientists said, no, we've painted ourselves into this corner. We need to start facing these unk-unks.
And in the Asilomar statement, which is still being worked on, but it will contain the word humility a number of times. Yeah. probably the first scientific document I've ever heard of that uses the word humility in a statement. I really recommend...
I want to ask the audience a question.
Okay.
Who thinks we should study... Who thinks that scientists should study geoengineering?
We have a really enlightened group here.
Well, maybe just because they say yes doesn't necessarily mean that's an enlightened answer.
We have someone who doesn't want to do it or something. Hey, no, let me get to the microphone. But I want to read, I really recommend this book. Margaret and I bought three. Hack the Planet reads like a sci-fi novel, but it's all the scarier because it's true. It's a really interesting, important book.
You mentioned a risk of like discussing geoengineering being the public not cutting emissions, but then...
It is moral hazard. If you wear a seatbelt, the fear goes, people will drive more wildly, but go on.
Right. I feel like the more you talk about the threat of geoengineering as being like what we have to do, I feel like the general public would be more afraid of experimenting on the earth and like using up money to do these things, and then that would inspire them to make...
I sure hope so. I think that's a great point. The idea is if the public sees scientists considering this radical option, maybe they'll realize the severity of the situation and how bad those worst case scenarios are. And I think you raise a really important point. We'll see. I mean, I had some trepidation naming my book Hack the Planet. It's a little... I don't know exactly how to describe it, but it's a little pushing it. But I think people ought to be shaken and understand that this is not a solution. It's a little bit of a hack, like hackers would mess with a computer system. You don't exactly know what effect it would have, and it's a little bit of an act of desperation.
Nice round of applause for Eli.